Good morning, folks. It is No Filter Friday. We've got a great lineup for you today. At 12:30, we'll visit with Mike Haas, voice of the Saints. The Saints and the Cardinals are playing this Sunday. Noon kickoff, first game of the season. A lot of excitement about it. We'll talk with Mike about that game. Chris Blair joins us at the top of the hour. He is the voice of the LSU Fighting Tigers, and LSU takes on Louisiana Tech at home, opening game there as well, and we'll get the particulars about what we can expect with that game, too. At 11:30, Colonel Alex Gann, retired colonel and fighter pilot for the Israeli Air Force, will talk about the most recent happenstance of the friction of the security cabinet and Benjamin Netanyahu over what to do with Gaza City. A number of different proposals are floating around, and we'll try to find out from Colonel Gann what is being talked about amongst the citizens of the state of Israel and what their thoughts are at the present time. We'll go open lines at 11, top of the hour. Want to hear from you on No Filter Friday. And at 10:30, Mark Hamrick joins us, Washington Bureau Chief and Senior Economic Analyst at Bankrate.com. The Jolts report's out, jobs report. We'll talk about what he's able to glean from those numbers and what they mean. So yesterday we talked a little bit about immigration with Andrew Arthur from the Center for Immigration Studies. He had been down in the Del Rio, Eagle Pass area on the border, both sites of some very contentious type of enforcement activities during the Biden administration, allegations flying around. We visited with him in order to gain a better understanding as to what is there now. Well, nada, nothing is there now. And that's what is reported out. But what we're beginning to see of things that occurred over those years in this country as a result of the lax enforcement at the border, I think is going to rock your world. In fact, a most recent report released by the High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area, otherwise known as HIDA, they put out a strategic analysis on the drug market and where we are. And this report is entitled Chinese Nationals and Marijuana in the United States. And it provides some really interesting information about what's happening here and why you cannot let your guard down at the borders. Because once the infiltration of the borders take place, in just a minute, you're going to hear what happens. The report starts out by saying there's an unprecedented expansion of Chinese-operated marijuana farms that has been tracked across the United States with operations stretching from California to Maine. Investigations have revealed a sophisticated network that has rapidly become the dominant force in America's illicit cannabis trade. Though these investigations' black market activities have been uncovered, stretching far beyond simple illegal grows. So this is not just a cottage industry. These operations involve the use of hazardous materials to fertilize the marijuana, sophisticated money laundering schemes, human trafficking, and organized crime networks that challenge law enforcement. Chinese marijuana operations now, believe it or not, dominate the U.S. illegal drug market. Let me say that again for you. Chinese marijuana operations now dominate the U.S. illegal drug market at levels never seen before. In fact, in the state of Oklahoma, that's right, Oklahoma, not California, not Colorado, not the state of Washington, all who have had a very historic lackadaisical approach to marijuana cannabis enforcement, the state of Oklahoma, right? Illegal marijuana production alone ranges from $18 to $44 billion a year. Chinese criminal groups run more than 80% of the marijuana farms, which shows a dramatic change in America's drug world. Oklahoma saw its licensed marijuana grows reach almost 10,000 by 2021, which provided perfect cover for the illegal side of their illegal operations, the illicit marijuana. Maine has become the latest target for this trade, with hundreds of suspected unlicensed grow houses now operating in the state. The operations have become more complex, as shown by recent Department of Justice charges. Seven Chinese nationals face accusations of running a multi-million dollar marijuana trafficking ring that focused on Massachusetts and Maine. And what was initially perceived as isolated cases has turned into coordinated criminal networks that span multiple states. So once they get in and they start dismantling these operations and they start interviewing these folks and debriefing them, what they're finding out is these are not one-offs. They're all connected. This is dangerous. We actually have foreign nationals in this country now running some of the largest illicit drug operations in the United States. Oklahoma became a hotspot for Chinese marijuana operations after voters said yes to medicinal marijuana in 2018. The state stood out because it did not limit the number of dispensaries or growing operations. To give you an example, California, with a population of 39.5 million people, has 4,600 licensed cultivation grow sites. Oklahoma has 3.9 million. 39.5 compared to 3.9, and Oklahoma has over 2,000 licensed sites. California has 1,800 licensed dispensaries, retailers. That's where you go buy the stuff. Oklahoma has just 400 less. But 30 million less people in that state. We'll give you an example of the breadth and depth and the penetration that the Chinese have made into the Oklahoma market. In 2023 alone, licensed cannabis production in Oklahoma exceeded licensed and medical marijuana demand by 32x. 32 times more marijuana was grown than what the demand was asking for, with enough capacity to meet the total state needs 4.5 times. From March 2024 to March 2025, there was 87,210,000 marijuana plants reported at licensed grow sites, but only 1.6 million pounds sold at dispensaries. 87 million plants, 1.6 million pounds sold at dispensaries. Remember, the theory is that all of this stays in the legal side to get to the medical dispensaries. Well, one plant typically equates to approximately 1 pound of processed marijuana. So let's do the math. There's 85.5 million plants that are unaccounted for. Go figure. There's very little regulatory oversight. These are predictions that anyone with half a lick of a sense in law enforcement had been making for years, that this is exactly what was going to happen. We knew it because we had seen it over and over and over again. So this equates into 153 billion dollars of value of illicit marijuana hitting the streets of our city. Black market marijuana, just in case you want to know, is going for about $1,800 a pound, right? So we're beginning to see the beginnings of the same thing happening in Maine. And I'm sure in the coming months we're going to be hit with any number of news stories as to what is going on and what is ultimately going to be happening there. But running parallel to this, and we all know that this is how this was going to work, right, is that we're seeing labor trafficking and worker exploitation. Big surprise. Their investigation reveals that there's a calculated recruitment scheme that has trapped thousands of Chinese workers in abusive conditions across multiple states. U.S. border authorities found 37,000 Chinese nationals crossing the southern border without proper documentation in 2023. And for the most part, they were all released into the interior. Now, the way that this works is they bring these folks across the border, right, and then they have to go work for these individuals for about 2 years to pay off what it costs them, about $20,000 per worker, to these trafficking networks. So they're working at all of these production facilities, distribution facilities, doing all the work and everything else. And guess what happens after 2 years, right? You have this person who thinks, I don't know why, that they're going to get away. They're going to do their 2 years of time for these very violent, aggressive, exploitative individuals, and they're going to go live life happily ever after in the United States of America. No, 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 no. What's the big problem? They know the entire operation. They know the location. They know too much. They're not going anywhere. And the ante gets upped over and over and over again, and these people never work their way out of what they have got themselves into. And all of this is going on in the interior of the United States, right? We are heaping criticism on our own leaders for doing certain things. And meanwhile, when you pull back a layer of the onion, you pull back the blankets, what you're going to find is something that's incredibly ugly. There's a whole side of the pesticides of this, too. You know, they do things different in China, right? The products that are exported to us are treated differently than the products that are consumed by the Chinese. So those practices were brought here as well because they don't consider themselves Americans. They consider that this product that they're putting into distribution and feeding to our kids, that it's okay to use these hazardous materials as fertilizer and pesticides and everything else because they don't give a damn. They're just here to make the money. They could care less. And that we could talk about that for days as to exactly what's going on and the archaic practices that they are deploying as they treat their plants in the hopes of getting them to market faster, right? And it goes on and on and on where there are connections between Chinese diplomats here in this country visiting these actual farms that are out there. You begin to wonder just how connected this is to the PRC. Well, you don't have to wonder much, right? This is a beautiful setup. So what are the ultimate takeaways here? And what should we be concerned about? Over 80% of illegal marijuana farms in the state of Oklahoma, where the illicit cannabis sales generate between $18 and $44 billion annually, are Chinese operated. Chinese nationals have been trafficked across the Mexican border. They're forced into debt bondage. They're working 14-hour shifts in dangerous conditions, and they're not being paid. Criminal networks use straw owners. You have shell companies set up all over the place and cultural associations as fronts maintaining connections to, go guess who? Yes, the Chinese government officials. Marijuana profits fund no big surprise here, other criminal enterprises, including fentanyl traffic, with millions being laundered through Chinese money networks. Law enforcement is facing overwhelming challenges here due to language barriers, jurisdictional limits, sophisticated coordination of transnational operations, encrypted communications that they're having to deal with as they are internationally engaged in their communications back to the country of China. This rapid expansion, too, is something to be really, really concerned about, because what they've been able to do is exploit the lack of regulatory oversight in states across this country. They've exhibited this incredible way of being able to adapt to moving operations across multiple states and do this with little or no intrusion by government actors. This is kind of scary. They've assessed our systems. They have figured out how to beat them. And remember, when you're growing plants in the numbers that we talked about earlier, right? 87,210,960 marijuana plants at licensed grow sites. And when we're doing the comparison to how much of that marijuana is actually hitting the medical dispensaries, there's a lot unaccounted for. Roughly, in this case, 85 point something million. Almost over 90% of the plants unaccounted for. How can that be? How can we be so willy-nilly about the risk to our kids, to our families? And we hadn't even talked about what they're lacing this marijuana with. That's another story for another day. This is the organizational structure and infrastructure that they've been able to abuse our systems, because for 4 years we weren't paying attention at the border. And we talked around what the real issues were. Everyone knew what was going to ultimately happen. And here it is in living color. Here it is in living color. Anecdotal stories of tractor trailer loads of cash, billions and billions of dollars of cash on illicit drug sales being brought out of this country into Mexico, right across the border, and we're not checking. We're too busy trying to catch up for what wasn't done for 4 years. We are whistling past the graveyard. At some point in time, this country had better come together, had better collaborate, had better cooperate, and had better get about resolving this issue. Because if we don't, do we believe that only Chinese nationals are going to do this? How many foreign countries are going to be operating illicit business organizations and operations inside the territorial boundaries of the United States for significant profits, wreaking havoc on our communities, making our communities less safe? And we're standing by with our hands in our pockets. It's not a pretty picture, folks. We'll be right back. Welcome back, folks. We're joined by Mark Hamrick, Washington Bureau Chief and Senior Economic Analyst at Bankrate.com. The JOLTS report is out. Mark, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you, Newell. And here we are. It's football season, autumn. I guess I was caught sleeping all summer with the time moving on so quickly. I hope you're doing well.
I am, and I'm very excited about the football season started. I need some time to be, you know, to be manipulated by something other than what I've been doing all summer long. So it works for me. So, what does this report reveal?
Well, Newell, let me fast forward a little bit because the Jolts report was released earlier in the week, and that gives
in
us
a view of
the number of job openings. And then this morning we had the monthly employment report, which tends to be a little more consequential. But I think overarching theme is largely the same, and my analysis and headlines on both are remarkably similar. So at least I win a point for consistency this week. I'll leave it to others about the accuracy. But, so the job openings number told us the job openings declined to nearly 7.2 million in July. That's the lowest in 10 months. And two drivers of employment in recent months saw the biggest declines, and those are healthcare and social assistance. And so whether you look at the job openings report, which, by the way, shows us that the number of job openings has fallen below the total number of unemployed for the first time in quite some time, or the monthly employment report that we had this morning, where we only added 22,000 jobs in August, actually now know that we had a contraction in employment in June, and the nation's unemployment rate rising to 4.3%. My overall thesis has been that this is largely a no-hire, no-fire job market. It's the last part of that, which is to some degree the salvation, because that's keeping the unemployment rate, at least so far, at a relatively low 4.3%, but that doesn't give us any guarantees for the future.
So when we look at healthcare's, for a couple of years now, has been one of the leaders, right, in job growth. Is there any underlying conditions that are driving these numbers down now?
It's our collective aging condition in this country, among other things. We do have an aging population, and we've known for some time that healthcare comprises a massive one-fifth of the U.S. economy, with subpar outcomes relative to our peers. And so we pay more for less favorable outcomes for healthcare in this country, speaking to a high degree of inefficiency and high cost. There are some fabulous things about the healthcare sector in our country. It's very innovative. You can have a high quality of care as long as you can afford it. It's, to bring the football analogy back around, if you're in the owner's suite, you're doing very well. If you're in the bleachers or knocking on the door from the outside, not so much. And so, we do have essentially the public commitment in the sense of Medicare and Medicaid, obviously the latter having been cut back recently by Congress, but those alone help to affirm a high degree of demand for health care. And then, of course, those of us that are fortunate enough to be working in the private sector have our employee benefit, which doesn't excuse us from having to pay out-of-pocket costs, but it helps to defray some of that.
But this translates into job loss. How? Because the demand is still up, right, for the services.
Well, we're not seeing job loss in healthcare per se, but rather with the Jolts report, we saw fewer job openings. And
right,
here in the August employment, that's okay. In the August employment report this morning, it was still a pillar of jobs creation, as it has been in recent months. And on July, we had 55,000 jobs added in healthcare. In August, we had 31,000. But the point is that we have a lot of mouths to feed and employment sectors in this economy, and right now you're only feeding a few of those.
Number of folks are saying that we're beginning to feel the pain of tariffs. Your thoughts?
Well, if I just go back and look at the monthly jobs creation numbers here, Newell, in April, we added 158,000. We know the announcement at the White House came in early April with regard to tariffs. So 158,000 jobs added in April, and it's been downhill ever since. So May, we added just 19,000 jobs. June, we lost 13,000 jobs. A little bit of a bounce back in July, 79,000 jobs added. And as we said this morning, 22,000 jobs added in August. As we talk about sectors, Newell, I think one of the more painful realities of this situation is that the argument could be made for quite some time now that the manufacturing sector in this country country has been in contraction mode. And when we look at the sectors, the goods producing sectors, including manufacturing, have not been adding jobs in the U.S. economy. And so you can draw the correlations or the causes, you know, however you might see fit, but we're just not seeing it for manufacturing.
Are we in a transition period, Mark, relative to some of the major manufacturing sectors? So, for example, automobiles. Less automobiles being produced, less need for manufacturing employees because the EVs and the EV market with the incentives going away is just kind of almost fundamentally disappeared.
Well, first of all, and I'm speaking as someone who owns EVs and very much a fan of the technology and the lack of monthly maintenance costs that's associated with that. You know, we still have pretty strong fundamental underlying demand for automobiles in this country. I think that EV demand is going to sort of level out at a certain point, leaving aside what the federal government was doing to help to, if we use the word juice, those numbers previously because of the tax incentives. I can see it when I go across any of my road trips, as I did last weekend, and a bigger road trip, 1,100 miles between here and where I live in Washington, D.C., or Canada, with the burgeoning number of charging stations. And that really is helping to address the number one concern that prospective and actual EV owners have, and that's range anxiety. Can I get the electricity charge that I need? So that's slowly but surely being addressed. And the reality is that for the owners, the economic incentive to own an EV is there without any help from Uncle Sam or anybody else. You don't have to pay the monthly maintenance costs in the form of oil changes, brake pad replacements, just so many things where the ongoing cost of an automobile is higher if it's an internal combustion engine. There are a lot of reasons to want to have an internal combustion engine, but the maintenance cost is not one of them. And so I think that fundamental shift is going to continue, whether this president's in office or the former president is no longer.
Yeah, but I mean, every day I open up, you know, news stories where manufacturers are announcing, we're not making this EV car anymore, we're not making this EV truck anymore, we're not making this EV SUV anymore, and they're not replacing it with additional SUV models. So to me, that's emblematic of they're having a problem selling these vehicles, and they're upside down. You know, and that is, if that's the case, those production facilities, they're laying people off. And, you know, and it's a pretty big sector of jobs out there for us, at least in the manufacturing world. And that's why I asked whether or not you thought, I'm not talking about, you know, the utilization and the life cycle of the EV market, but at this point in time right now, do we see this reaction to what's happening September 30th? The incentives go away. And do we see this? And we also, interestingly, I was reading a report the other day of how many EV vehicles are being turned in at the present time and to dealers when they buy new cars that are combustion engine cars, which is kind of interesting as well.
Well, first of all, somebody's going to buy those used vehicles. They aren't being obliterated. And so if anything, that's an entry point at, let's say, $22,000 on an EV that previously cost $40,000. Those are selling as well. So those don't go away. But I think the point is that, you know, there's absolutely has had to have been a readjustment on the part of some of the manufacturers to align with ongoing demand. And, you know, there was sort of there was an incentive for the manufacturers and consumers to perhaps buy at levels that weren't sustainable previously. But I think all that will level out in time. And, we're still an automobile reliant society, even with all the utilization of ride sharing. If you're in Los Angeles, you see the Waymo robotic cars happening. That's a quite mind-blowing phenomenon. There probably is a disincentive for people to buy cars in the future, simply because among the pain points are the high ongoing cost of monthly insurance and, of course, registration and maintenance being at least part of the equation for most of the automobile owners out there. So I think, if anything, and this is what Tesla believes, this is what Waymo believes, the people that are looking at this in the long term, is that there are going to be some disincentives for people to own automobiles, even though there are obviously many areas of the country, particularly rural and small towns across America, where those ride-sharing options just are largely irrelevant.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, it's going to be a challenge for that manufacturing sector for years to come. It's not going away, obviously, not by any stretch of the imagination. But I was just looking at the as you pointed out, the observation you made, that's the what, that's the outcome. I'm looking to try and identify the why. Why are we having this experience? And I guess I could almost say it's kind of at an accelerated rate, right? Because we've not seen drops like this historically.
Well, if you're talking about the EV adoption issue alone.
No, I'm just talking about jobs, bringing this back to jobs, manufacturing, coming back to the job numbers, something, this is the outcome. And I'm trying to figure out why, like in the auto world, why are we seeing these reductions,
Well, for one, we have something that hadn't happened in 100 years, and that is the highest average effective tariff rate in place. And, if one were to look at, for example, the Institute for Supply Management monthly reports, particularly the manufacturing reading, or the Federal Reserve's Beige Book report that we had earlier this week, the impacts of tariffs are very real. We're talking about higher input costs, higher costs that they have to manage, and there is the diminished demand where, if you're looking at a product coming in from India now with a tariff of 50%, that, for example, is a large supplier, among other things, of jewelry. Consumers aren't going to raise their hand and say, yeah, I'm all on board on paying those increased costs. So this tariffs issue can be what I think Federal Reserve officials are largely aligning in their view upon, and that is that it can be a one-time price adjustment. Why that's significant is that it doesn't necessarily ensure that we're going to have, let's say, the everlasting experience with inflation that feels like we've had since 2022, and that may be the excuse the Federal Reserve officials used to lower interest rates in mid-September. I think the problem is with sort of saying that it's a one-time price adjustment is we don't know if the administration is going to continue to move that bouncing ball up and down as it's the favored tool of the White House.
And then you have the added uncertainty of the court, of potential court action.
Yeah,
right.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely. Because we don't know if they're legal or not.
Right. You don't know if what's going to ultimately come out of there either. As always, truly enjoy the conversation with Mark Hamrick. Thank you so much for your time and your insight, and have a great weekend.
You too, my friend. All the best. Thank you.
Thank you. That's Mark Hamrick, Washington Bureau Chief and Senior Economic Analyst at Bankrate.com. We'll be right back, folks. Folks, don't forget that LSU takes on Louisiana Tech tomorrow in Tiger Stadium. Start your game day at 2 o'clock with Mike Dettillier and Herb Tyler and the Gulf Coast Bank and Trust Tiger Tailgating Show live from Acme Oyster House in Baton Rouge. Come out and count down to the big game at Acme with 16 surround sound TVs and the best drink specials. It's a great place to hang out for LSU and college football, all thanks to the good folks at MAP Construction. Then at 4:30, catch LSU's official pregame show. Kickoff is 6:30 with the voice of the Tigers, Chris Blair, and color analyst Jacob Hester. Tigers versus Bulldogs tomorrow on WWL and streaming live on the free Odyssey app. And also, one of my favorites is high school football. I don't know about you. I love high school football. And so get ready for week one of Friday Night Lights and the most comprehensive high school football show in America, the Manning Family Children's Prep Football Roundup. Join Ian Ozant and Coach Lou Valden, and every Friday night at 7, they'll have prep reporters stationed at key games in the metro area across epic battles in southeast Louisiana, bringing you live updates and one-on-ones with the winning coaches. This week's top battles, Shaw versus Edna Carr at Edna Carr, De La Salle at Central, Rummel at Lafayette Christian, Franklinton at a meet, and Lutcher at Slidell. And we'll talk about the upcoming high school football season with the LHSAA ED Eddie Bonine. Get ready for another exciting year of high school football, the Manning Family Children's Prep Football Roundup presented by Acadian Companies and Dr. Pepper tonight and every Friday night from 7 to 10:30 on WWL and the free Odyssey app. We will be right back, folks. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. When we return after the top of the hour news break, we will go to open lines. Would love to hear from you what you're thinking about on No Filter Friday. We can talk about any issue you like. I'll throw a couple out there. And in the back half of the hour, we'll visit with Colonel Alex Gann, retired colonel and fighter pilot for the Israeli Air Force. And we'll talk about the strategies around taking down Gaza City. There seems to be some internal friction with the security forces and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. We'll get his thoughts and what he's hearing on in the streets of Israel. So we'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. This is Newell on WWL.